You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares.
Good morning, welcome to the show. Bank holiday in the UK, Monday, May the 6th. Touchdown at Heathrow about an hour and a half ago and was reassured by a nice, damp, grey, cool day here in the UK. So what happened over the weekend? You can hear Lydia Hislop chuckling in the background. Extraordinary Guineas, extraordinary Kentucky Derby. Guineas first of all. City of Troy flopped big time in the Kipco 2000 Guineas, a race that went to notable speech. First horse since 1938 to win the Guineas unraced as a two-year-old, and first horse to win the Guineas having never raced on turf before. And he didn't just win, he bolted up and beat Rosalian and Hartem. All three of them can look forward to productive campaigns. What next for City of Troy, we wonder. As for the 1000 Guineas, the comeback man, we'll be talking to him in a minute, Sylvester D'Souza, 10-month ban for breaching betting regulations in Hong Kong. The toughest of times imaginable. He's back. He's the sort of man who just makes things happen. He won on El Malka for Roger Varian at 28-1. There were any amount of hard luck stories in that race. Chief amongst them, perhaps Tamfana, trained by David Menuisier, who also joins us later in the program to outline plans for her. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, where I was, just extraordinary. Kenny McPeak, Kentucky-based trainer, veteran trainer, over 2,000 winners. His quest for Kentucky Derby glory ended in victory for Mystic Dan under the most daredevil ride around the inside from Brian Hernandez. For good measure, the pair had teamed up to win the Kentucky Oaks the previous day with Torpedo Anna, the first trainer and jockey combination to win the Kentucky Oaks and Derby in the same year since trainer Ben Jones, the legendary Ben Jones, did it back in the 1950s. So lots upon which to reflect with Lydia now. Lydia, where to start? I think what now for City of Troy, surely?
Yes, I feel like we ought to start with the winner because I think he's brilliant. But let's go with City of Troy. So, I've kind of been thinking at the end of last season. I thought this is an outstanding two-year-old, as he obviously was. And the question over the winter would be: would he be able to upgrade his form and become an utterly outstanding 3- and 4-year-old? Because the comparisons with Frankel were already starting to be made, understandably, based on his 2-year-old performances and the manner of his victories. However, there we also know that precocity can be caught up on. You know, your peers grow more, mature more, find more. But quite often, the 2000 Guineas can still reward lingering precocity ahead of horses that go on to mature and have better careers at 3 and at 4. At this point, I mean, I asked the question when I was began the racing TV broadcast on Saturday, what kind of Dewhurst winner was he? Was he an Air Force Blue, just an outstanding two-year-old? Was he a Pinatubo, not quite good enough to win the Guineas after not much upgrading his form as a three-year-old? Or Dawn Approach, who just slightly upgraded his form as a three-year-old and did manage to win a Guineas? Or would he unthinkably be a Frankel and go on hugely at 3 and then at 4? Well, at the moment, unfortunately, City of Troy's performance, just looking at that barely, falls into the Air Force Blue category. He was beaten very, very early on. And of course, people have pointed to Auguste Rodin, who bounced back from a poor showing in the 2000 Guineas this time last year to go on and win the Derby and other top races. However, there weren't the other background humming worries about Auguste Rodin at the same point. You know, he had grown and there wasn't a family trait. So at this point, I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see how people approach City of Troy's next race, if indeed we do see him again.
Well, Lydia and I recorded that earlier on today, and I'm updating this podcast now because Aidan O'Brien called me back, and this is what he has had to say about City of Troy on Saturday.
Maybe, thinking back on it, maybe I had him too fresh and hadn't enough done with him through the whole winter. Our ground has been very bad and very deep here, that's what's going on in my mind, and he just jumped and ran fresh and then just blew out, you know. So I think that's the reason, Nick, and obviously we know more the next time, but hopefully that'll be the end of that. But I think that if I was to go back in my own head, that's what I think could have happened, you know.
I mean, people make a lot of horses when they're disappointed in the guineas. They say that, well, they haven't trained on, and he's not that big. Yes. What's your view on that?
No, Nick, like, honest to God, I stood into him before he got tacked up, and I stood into him again this morning. He's just under 16-1. That means he's plenty big for anything. He's very well made, so he looks a lot smaller than he is. And obviously, when he went into the stalls, he stood straight up straight away. And for me, that meant that he was too fresh. And obviously, when that happens, their heart rate will rise straight away. And he landed, and then the gates opened. So he wouldn't have got a chance for that to go back. So he would have been racing straight away. So there's every chance. Like, if he was needing the run and he was too fresh, is at halfway, his heart could not go any higher. So it could not go any higher, only drop down. And I think that that's what happened to him, Nick. We were happy with everything he'd done. And Nick, he was always very natural at home and always done everything very easy. And listen, that if he was a horse that hadn't as much ability, he'd probably been finding his work harder than he was finding it. So that's what I'm putting it down to, obviously.
And do you have an idea, if he's fine, are you inclined to roll the dice again fairly soon?
No, well, he's still on the same plan. Obviously, we always make a plan, and obviously every part of the plan doesn't always go right, and that's what we're just going to put this down to now. And that's what, the next time, obviously, we know an awful lot more.
So you're still inclined to bowl on towards the Derby?
Yeah, no, the plan is that he goes straight to the Derby. Obviously, if everything is well over the next coming weeks and all that, obviously.
And what did you make of Ilang Ilang's run? Actually, to be honest, we had a conversation last week and she ran pretty much exactly as you thought she would, I thought.
Yeah, that's exactly. She was working like an Oaks filly, more than a Guineas filly, but working like a filly that could run a very big race in the Guineas. And we felt that that's what she did do, and looked like a filly that was going to definitely step up to a mile and a quarter. And usually, if they have enough class over a mile and a quarter, they have a good chance of getting a mile and a half in Epsom.
Aidan O'Brien there talking to me as I update this edition of the podcast. Earlier on, Lydia and I, of course, also reflected on the winning performance of Notable Speech.
I think it was a outstanding performance. First go on turf. I think I'm expecting him to be better on sort of summer fast turf as well. There was some hints in the sectionals that he'd managed to deliver at Kempton, particularly last time out when William Buick said at the time that he'd been trying to teach the horse something. So he gave him quite a lot to do in the straight at Kempton, and he was able to overcome it in a closing sectional speed, which was really very notable. He's got a tremendous turn of foot. He's now proved himself to be versatile on turf and or weather. He's got a great temperament. He looks like a bang miler to me, and we're going to see him next in the St James's Palace Stakes. And he brought William Buick his first 2,000 guineas after many attempts. And of course, Native Trail was second to Caribus, the stable companion, 2 years ago when Charlie Appleby won his first and James Doyle was on the winner. More of him later, because he was on the other side of the way that the coin toss goes for jockeys on 1,000 guineas day. But a really important win as well for Charlie Appleby, because he's made no secret of feeling that he has been building back up after one lesser season.
Slightly less good fortune for him in the US. More of that in a little while. Let's discuss the 1,000 guineas. Before we do, perhaps we ought to hear from the winning rider, Sylvester D'Souza. Now, this is a jockey. He's been a champion jockey in the UK on more than one occasion, who has had lots of ebbs and flows to his career. And it was threatening to ebb away earlier last year because he got a 10-month ban from the Hong Kong Jockey Club for a betting-related offence. But he's got himself back, got himself riding out, got himself to Roger Varian's and got himself a ride in the Kipco 1,000 guineas. And that ride was a winning one. His first British Classic success on El Malka. How is he feeling the morning after?
Oh, absolutely amazing. And, went to work this morning, tough to beat. And I couldn't wait to start this morning, because I was so happy and so thrilled myself. And, everything happened yesterday.
Let's talk about the race first. At what point did you actually think something was starting to happen?
It's just when you come down the bushes, you know, from too far long out. And I fell, only had a couple of lengths to make up, you know. I could see the French horse in front and Donna Cobra's horse just in front of me. And I felt like I could challenge them because I was just getting my feel organized. And when she hit the deep and, you know, she changed leads and she rolled in a little bit, and I thought, I'm going to pick them up, you know. And she just put her head down and galloped her out, like, you know, and she's still learning, but she done it in good fashion for me.
What confidence did Roger give you before the race?
We was a little bit in the dark side because she worked well, but she's never flash at work. But I think the decision he took to run her was in her back run when she finished third at Newbury. And, you know, and he asked me how she worked, and I told him my opinions, and he took a decision to run. And but, hey, he's just thrilled, like, you know, and sitting on. She's not very big, but she galloped out with her heart, you know.
Sylvester, you and I have talked already this season about how tough it's been to get back. You had a 10-month ban after leaving Hong Kong. During that time, did you think a resurrection this speedy was possible?
No, never. I was considering myself as just, you know, getting a few rides and the B meetings, you know, and I never thought, you know, I could challenge or have a ride in the classic, to be honest, you know. I was just happy to fill my books up and whatever way I could go, you know.
Who set you on the right path to making sure you could get good rides and get in the mix again?
And I went when I only had a month left to come back, and I phoned him up, Roger, and I asked him if I could ride out, you know. So, and he's accepted me in the yard, and I just been turning up every morning, you know, from Monday to Monday. And he's just a team, like, you know, probably, you know, he's just a team meant to be happening, you know.
One thing I know about you is you've got a significant amount of mental strength. You've bounced back from plenty of knocks before. You've had lots of ups and downs in your career. Just how tough was this one to get back from?
It's, you know, wasn't easy, to be honest. You know, especially when you stay 10 months just watching people do what you love to do, you know, and you're not able to, you know, and they wouldn't let you do it. So it was very tough, you know, and ups and downs and, you know, private life. But yeah, I'm doing what I love now, and I just hope to keep going.
And you're someone who, and you're off to Beverly today, you're someone who, it seems to me, thrives on the relentlessness of it. You don't mind riding all day, every day.
No, I don't. And, you know, keep my mind busy, and it's a good thing. And, you know, it's like they would say, I'm doing what I love to do, you know. And is I don't mind to go anyway for good rides or rides. And, you know, if I can't get good rides, I have to make the rides I get come to be good, you know, have to make them good, you know. So, and you have to go where you get the rights at the end of the day, you know. I can't sit at home, is a race in Newmark, and say, oh, I can't have a ride in Newmark, it's only two in Beverly, I'm not going to Beverly. No, I'm going to Beverly, because that's the place I get the rights, you know. So,
I better let you get to Beverly. Congratulations.
Okay, thanks a million. Thank you.
Sylvester D'Souza there, acknowledging that this has been a particularly tough time, thrilled to ride his first British Classic winner, that long overdue in itself, ban notwithstanding. And I thought, Lydia, when they passed the post, I looked down and I thought, of course, Sylvester D'Souza, he's just, you can't keep him out of the action. He's just always in the thick of it somewhere, making things happen.
Yeah, and things have happened to him. And, you know, most recently, as you say, he went to Hong Kong because he lost his job with King Power Racing. Then in Hong Kong, he received a 10-month ban for assisting fellow jockey Wagner Borges to place bets on horse racing. He's come back here. Roger Varian was one of the first people to make touch with him. He the trainer of Amalka, he invited him to come in and ride out. So that was an association that Sylvester D'Souza was able to build up straight away. And he has put his formidable persistence and application to building back his career better here in Britain. And before, he said he's never come close to winning a classic before, and now he's won the 1,000 Guineas. And the thing you particularly note about Sylvester de Souza is more often than not, he's in absolutely the right place within the race, and he is travelling up and down the country. He works hard. He's got talent, and he's got that workhorse approach, which is a deadly combination. If you've got a lot of talent and you're prepared to put in the application, then you're hard to get past, aren't you?
You are. And it may well be that he at some point finds himself on this filly again. Now, James Doyle is clearly the stable's number one choice this season, and Roger Varian made no secret of that after the race. But given James's commitments to Wathnam Racing First, it is not inconceivable that there will be another conflict of interest at some point.
Absolutely. And, you know, Sylvester de Souza was on Charon when he put up a career best performance winning the Sandown Mile a couple of weeks ago. And after that race, he was talking about how he was essentially appealing to people who were watching racing TV and basically saying, you know, I'm back, I'm hungry, I'm going to put the work in. If you employ me, you know, I will do you a good job. And he was keen to sort of say that, you know, he very much thanked Roger Varian, and clearly he thanked him fully for what he achieved yesterday at Newmarket. But this is somebody who is going to be putting the work in, and it's already beginning to pay off.
Oh, hard luck stories are plenty.
Oh, yeah.
In the 1,000 Guineas. Oh. We'll pick them apart in a minute. Let's hear from the hardest luck story of all, shall we? First of all, David Menuisier, who trained Tam Farner, never got a clear run at all. Virtually finished on the bridle and was finishing over all of them in a very, very close up fourth. These were his thoughts a little earlier today.
Yeah, no, mixed feelings this morning. Obviously, very proud. Very proud of the filly and of what she's achieved, because in her mind, she won the race yesterday. But obviously extremely disappointed by the result, you know, because we were so close, but so far, obviously. So, yeah, a bit of mixed feelings, but we'll get over it.
It's people's natural reaction when a horse doesn't get a clear run and is a very fast finisher to wonder what the jockey might have done differently. I noted last night on social media you were quite quick to respond to any critics of Jamie Spencer. Talk me through it from a trainer's perspective.
But look, from a trainer's perspective, I can't see what Jamie could have done differently, you know? I mean, I've spoken again to him this morning. I just can't see, watching the replay, what else he could have done. Now social media is what it is, and it's becoming a trend now. If Jamie does this, he gets shut down. If he does that, he gets shut down as well. So I'm sure he's used to it, and I don't pay too much attention to what people think. I just felt that actually had the gap. Watching the race live with some of the owners, she looked like the winner all the way through. She had exactly the same position as the 2,000 Guineas winner the day before. But he got the gap and we didn't. And that's the way it is. Look, I should have won the Ebor last year because of the same circumstances. And it happened before, it will happen again. So we just have to, you just have to be philosophical the next day, lick your wounds and carry on, really, you know?
So what now to build on what was a tremendous performance? How do you plot your way through the rest of the year?
We just do as we planned all along, you know. I never saw the Guineas as a target, rightly or wrongly. To me, the target was always the jam. So we'll just carry on and have this as our main focus, because I think she will improve again, you know, in terms of fitness. I don't think she was at her optimum fitness yesterday. So the race would have brought her on.
And worth just reminding everybody where you got her from and how much she was.
Yeah, as I've said to you before, I can't take the credit for buying her. Jeremy Brumit bought her. But yeah, she only cost €20,000 at the Baden-Baden yearling sale. So, yeah, I said to Jeremy yesterday, if you could do the same again this year, even for double the price, we'll be happy.
There was a special result for you over the weekend because you won the John Dunlop Condition Stakes at Goodwood. Now, admittedly, your Devil's Point was an 11-4 on favourite, but what level of satisfaction did it give you to win the race named for one of your mentors?
Yeah, look, I mean, it was a very proud moment, and we used the race as a stepping stone to go and run in the German Guineas, which was also the plan I told you about when you invited me. He ran okay in the Jebel, got tired, so we used that conditions race to really bring him on before the German Guineas. Now it was a very proud moment. And it's always special to win on our local track as well. So no, it was a good day.
I loved another Clive Washbourne special. The winning owner, who, if anyone's not familiar with Clive, everyone will be, I'm sure. But if you're not, you'll hear him soon. Particularly if Keyes Chorister builds on that performance in the Cigarro and goes on and wins the Gold Cup. He seems to think you're going to. Do you share his confidence in your filly?
Confidence of winning the Gold Cup, I don't know. I think she'll run a good race. But she's amazing, and you never... we've had her in training for 2.5 years. She started handicapping at 53. She'll probably be rated above 110 tomorrow morning. She's amazing. She keeps on surprising, so... You know, being lucky enough to be at the top table of the stayers in Europe is extraordinary, really. So whether she can win or not, I don't know, but we'll give it a good go anyway.
And of course, she's a homebred. So again, another great story.
Another great story, because she's the daughter of the first yearling I ever bought when I set up as a trainer. And the full sister, I bought the dam of Keyes Chorister, and her full sister became my first stakes winner, Avoir de Paix. And this one was pretty good of her own. I mean, she won three races, she broke the track record at Beverly over 2 miles. So it's a very, very good story all along.
All right, that was David Menuisier, philosophical and looking forward. And there's an extraordinary and poignant and rather sad postscript to that interview, Lydia, which was that Soldier Hollow, the sire of Tam Fana, who cost them just 20 grand in Germany, died this morning. So
really?
I'm rather hoping that she leaves him with a serious legacy now.
Oh wow, isn't life strange in that kind of way? She was really unlucky. I don't feel it was jockey error at all. In fact, Jamie Spencer made the right decision in taking her back, because if you look in the early part of the races, five of the horses that ended up finishing in the first six places were in the last five places in the race. It was an advantage to be patiently ridden, which Tam Fana was. She was just unfortunate that at the time that Jamie Spencer was looking to begin to move forward, some horses that weren't going so well started weakening back onto him, and he had to switch repeatedly in order to make up ground. When she got clear, she had a lot of ground to make up, and she almost did it. She was really unfortunate. She's a very likeable filly. She'd shown plenty of promise in the Prix en Prudence when she ran on seasonal debut, and she will do well. I mean, she'll be do well at distances from a mile to 10 furlongs, you would think. And so I can understand them going for the Prix de Diane. She was unfortunate. The other way of looking at it is that Ramatuelle, maybe had she been held on to a little bit longer, but really the damage was done by the horses at the fore doing so much, and she was so keen, and that is typical her. That will be her, or has been her, undoing. In the Imprudence, she saw a lot of daylight early and she was a bit too keen and sort of didn't accept the lead that she was wanted to be given, or the position that she was wanted to be given, and Romantic Style was able to do it much more straightforwardly than her. It's interesting, Christopher Head has got a decision to make about Royal Ascot. He's got two entries for her. He's got the Coronation Stakes around a bend where he would have a rematch with Al Malka, or he's got the straight track 6 furlong Commonwealth Cup where he would be able to allow Ramatuelle to give full vent to that speed that she has, and yeah, should be able to get plenty of cover. They might get cover if they're lucky with the draw in the Coronation.
I'd love the Commonwealth Cup if Van Dijk wasn't in the way.
Yeah, I get that. I get that. But I think, I mean, she's definitely trained on. She's not, there's not very much of her. I mean, you look at City of Troy in the paddock and you wouldn't be impressed. And he, you know, has ran like that. You look at Ramatuelle in the paddock and you wouldn't be impressed. And she didn't run like that. So, you know, she has definitively trained on. There's not a great deal of Almarca as well, but we already knew she'd train on because of her slightly unfortunate third in the Fred Darling. But Ramatuelle is that she's got the keen going demeanour of a sprinter. And with a little bit of cover, I feel like the Commonwealth Cup just got a huge chance. So she didn't help herself get home in the 1,000 guineas. And Aurélien Lemaître's body language as they crossed the line, because it looked for all the world inside the final furlong that she and he had won. And then he's passed twice near the line, both by the winner and also by Porta Fortuna.
Okay. Who, in your opinion, if you were to do a league table of trainers whose glass is always half full, where would let's throw some names around. I'll start with Richard Hannon, shall I?
And half we'll work full. On that. Half full. Three quarters full, I'd say.
Can you raise me? William Muir.
Brimming over.
Anyone else you can think of?
No, I'm immediately thinking of the ones at the other end of the scale. Henry Candy.
Well, Henry Candy and Sir Mark Prescott would be down
Roger,
the other.
Roger Charlton when he was when he had a license and he wasn't assisting his son.
Henry Daly.
Oh, perfect. Eel.
He's down the
Brilliant.
Other end. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got the kind of either end of the spectrum. Kenny McPeak, the man who's trained the winner of the Kentucky Oaks and the Kentucky Derby. I would say there isn't a more glass half full trainer. They're always going to win. They are always going to win.
I know Kenny a little bit from when he's come over to Britain. I bumped into him in the car park at Royal Ascot last year. It was great to see him and say hello and catch up with him. I'm absolutely delighted for him.
Well, indeed. And quite often they do. You know, he's trained over 2,000 winners, but he hadn't trained a Kentucky Derby winner, nor indeed a Kentucky Oaks winner. Now he's trained both, making history in so doing, teaming up with Brian Hernandez, an excellent jockey. But I did say to Kenny McPeak when I spoke to him yesterday, I said that I know you are the most glass half full trainer of all time, but even this must have come as a surprise to you. What do you think he said, Lydia?
No, not at all.
Let's have a listen.
Actually, no. I actually expected to win both races. I had two horses that were doing fantastic. And I probably, you know, you have to go into these things positive, but I really had ultra confidence. I mean, the filly, I thought that I was going to be very disappointed if they beat her. I was going to be very surprised if they beat her because she was just sitting on tilt. And the colt is, you know, just a fantastic colt. And he has such a great mind. And that's what we need. You know, you got to take a horse. Yesterday, he stood in the paddock like he was a 20-year-old pony. He just is very. He's an old soul, and he smart and fast, obviously. But no, I had extremely confident. For some reason, I just felt like the last two or three weeks that we're going to win both these.
So everything just felt right. It did. You just had that. You had that hunch inside you that not only did you have the talent in terms of the horse flesh to win the race, but that things were going to go right for you.
Well, you've got you know, for those of us out there that handle horses on a daily basis, you're constantly, you know, worrying about this and that and how they're eating and how their shoeing is going and whether they're you know, feeling how they're, you know, their every movement you're worried about. And I was searching for, you know, hey, is there anything, any problems I need to solve, or there weren't any. I mean, it was, I had two horses that were eating well. I had horses that were feeling well. I had horses that were, just in amazing condition. And I had a jockey that we felt like we were on the same page. And, I had an ownership group, two ownership groups that were happy and enjoying the whole, I mean, and I think you have to have positive energy and mojo, and you have to eliminate any negativity. We had none. It was just literally walking through a dream.
I mean, in fairness, we talk about Thorpedo Anna, your Oaks winner, first of all. We were all asked to give our picks, and I picked something else in the race. And then I looked at her for the first time, and I thought, well, if that can gallop, they're not going to beat her because she's a monster.
Yeah, she's big beast. And when I worked them together, during the winter, I mean, she gave him fits in the workouts. I mean, I didn't work them. I worked them together two or three times, and I'm like, oh, I probably ought to separate them because they want to go too fast. And she was, you know, she's, my quote was, is they better bring a bear because I'm bringing a grizzly, because she's just a big, strong filly and a great doer, and makes our job easy.
But you're not going to take her to the Preakness. Does that suggest that you are going to run Mystic Dan in the Preakness?
Well, she's definitely not going to the Preakness. You know, at this point, I don't know that even he's going to go. I've run him back on 2 weeks rest before, and it backfired on me. You know, we want to have a good year with him, and not necessarily, you know, we're not going to try to force this at all. And with her, she'll either probably go in the Acorn or the Belmont. I wouldn't be scared to do that if I thought that was the right thing. And then him, if he doesn't run in the Preakness, he'd probably come back in the Belmont. That gives him 5 weeks spacing. Or I could bring them both over for the English Derby and the English Oaks, right?
All right, go on.
I like teasing you guys.
Well, listen, Dr. Devious ran in the Kentucky Derby. 1992, you were a keen student of history, came back and won the Derby a couple of weeks later. Now, if anyone would do something as batty as that, it's you.
This is true. You know, I actually would just, I wouldn't be scared at all to do that. And this is the colt. He'd handle the grass no problem. He's so agile. I think you need to be agile to you know what, make the left hand turn to Tatnam Corner. I can see him scooting around the corner. He's very Northern Dancer-ish. I mean, he's got a lot of Northern Dancer look to him. It's the sire line Northern Dancer. You know, I've always been a student of the history of the sport and the pedigrees and how it all ties together. And, you know, yeah, he would handle that. And she's just a, you know, prolific talent. And, you know, I had disappointment there in the Oaks once, and, you know, I'd love to come back with the right horse, and, you know, but maybe this isn't the season, but, you know,
you're teasing me, aren't you?
Yeah. You know what? I've never been scared to. I think that this is what horse racing is about, and, you know, to do interesting things, especially if you have horses that can take you there. And we will, you know, right now we're just going to absorb the moment and, just take a little time to think about everything. And I'll go back this afternoon, check everybody at feed time, and tomorrow morning it'll be interesting too. We've got to get movement to Saratoga. We've got to get horses up there. That starts tomorrow. But just amazing weekend.
But you're not there. We're not going to Pimlico with either of them. I think that's what I'm deducing.
No, that's well, an old friend of mine said years ago, he's never make a decision until you absolutely positively have to. No fast moves. And I can't say either or right now, but, you know, look, we'll look at all the factors, and, you know, more than anything, it's the horses are well, and they take us there as opposed to, you know, pushing them there.
Just a word on Brian Hernandez, who, you know, I saw last night, and he looked pretty shell-shocked, and everyone was coming up and congratulating him. He's such a humble man. He really is. A very nice man, too. But what are his strengths as a rider?
Well, you know, he's a consummate professional. There's no drama in our barn. We rode together. I've never had a crossword with him, never had any doubt that he was doing the best he could. Even when a race didn't go well, we discuss it and we regroup and start back and try again. You know, I just enjoy working with him. I mean, it's not unusual for our families to hang out. You know, we've gone to Mardi Gras parades with Brian and Jamie, his wife, all our kids, and in New Orleans, which is a, you know, great event. And you know, look, there's nothing complicated about him. He's just a great rider. I like the Cajun riders. You know, Robbie Alvarado won the Preakness for me. You know, I just really enjoy using those guys. Are so savvy, and I don't know where they get it. It must be in the water in Louisiana or something, but they're so savvy.
You were raised in Lexington. You're a Kentucky based guy. You've won a Preakness, you've won a Belmont, you've won over 2,000 races, you've won just about every big race in the state of Kentucky going. How does it feel now to have caught an Oaks and Derby Double and to become just the third trainer to do it in the same year? I mean, how much does that complete you?
Well, I felt like I was complete before that, but, you know, Yeah, I'm really proud of it. It's something I sniffed at back in 2002 when I had Take Charge Ladies, the favorite of the Oaks, and I had Harlan's Holiday as a favorite in the Derby that year. And those races didn't unfold our way, but, you know, you learn from them. And I don't know. I'm really proud of my team and my clients that I work with. And, you know, at this stage in my career, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. Don't move as quick as I did. I'm not as thin as I used to be. But, you know, I think I learned to enjoy it a little bit better, and I don't try to control a lot of things. And, you know, I what's in within my realm of what I need to worry about, and then I'll, the rest of it I'll let it go. And, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm gonna let this go and enjoy it, let it happen, and as opposed to, you know, dwelling and, you know, like, it's just what we do. And nothing's better than putting a smile on people's faces, and the people that own these horses and have followed them. I mean, it just thrills me that everybody else is able to enjoy it too.
Kenny, thank you. Thank you for telling me your race tactics beforehand as well. They worked out absolutely spot on.
Well, when Dornak broke bad, I was like, oh, that kind of changes things. But of course, Brian did the right thing. He let him run. And one thing we did do that I think was the key is that I popped him out of the gate on Wednesday. And I told the team, I said, you know, like, we're going to do something because he needs to be, you know, fleet-footed leaving there. You cannot get flat-footed leaving the gate in the Kentucky Derby, or you're going to get in trouble. And, you know, and he's an easy horse to handle, so it made it all a lot simpler.
Kenny, thanks. Congratulations.
Thanks, Nick.
Right. That was the excellent Kenny McPeak giving as good copy as I expected.
I said I knew him a bit.
The morning after the Kentucky Derby. But of course, that experience in the Oaks with Daddy's Little Darling, who didn't start because she bolted on the way to the start and Olivier Pelly had to bail out, he clearly wants to come back and do it again. You know, he said if he had owners that were game enough, he would actually consider running this Kentucky Derby winner in the Derby.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
A la Dr. Devious. But he said, don't stir the pot because it's not likely to happen. But they're not. I mean, lots of things have been thrown up off the back of this. The first one of them is, looks like no Kentucky Derby runner at all is going to run in the Preakness unless he makes a last minute decision, starts to beg the question, is the Triple Crown only 6 years after its last winner, Justify, now dead and buried?
What do you think?
Well, I think now Pimlico simply are going to have to move the Preakness because trainers are not going to withstand a two-week break, and there isn't enough of a financial inducement, I don't think. So two things have got to happen. I think you've got to start forgetting the argument that the whole thing's about pressing three races into 5 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever, because they're just not going to swallow it. Yeah, you can't force people to run horses. So if it's going to retain any relevance, then the Preakness is going to have to move, and the Belmont Stakes is going to have to move. Now, Belmont Park this year have gone to Saratoga, and they're running the Belmont Stakes at 10 furlongs, which makes it a bit of a farce anyway as an entity this year. But presuming it goes back to Belmont in timely fashion and then is then run over 12 furlongs, then I think they all have to grow up and space out. Mm. Otherwise, it does die as an entity, and that becomes quite clear. And there had to be a great financial inducement, because with all the money on offer elsewhere in the world and through the summer in New York, there's just not enough of an incentive to drive on to Pimlico. And it's such a shame, because you've got this huge viewing audience who watched on Saturday who they want to keep following the story through.
Am I having massive deja vu? But didn't you make this argument this time last year? And I think you're right. You can't force trainers to run horses they don't think are ready to run. And whilst America, like elsewhere in the world, is having a very loud welfare conversation, trying to push horses into a TV or nostalgia-driven schedule is just not good enough. And the sport has got to take a deep breath, take a step back and be more grown up about it. I mean, that, you know, we've had to do it in Britain. We've had to do it with the Grand National more than once. So, yes, I don't know what impact that's not knock on impact that is going to have on the American program. But clearly, if you want the Triple Crown to remain a thing, it has got to be more sympathetic to what the actual needs of the horses it relies on are. Yeah.
One of my colleagues put it neatly last night, said this is a sport that likes to eat its young. It is extraordinary how it can cannibalize itself and not make the best of an opportunity. Against trends across the globe, Saturday's event seems to be performing well, both in terms of attendance, up to 156,710. There were 107,000 people there on Friday on Oaks Day. Mm-hmm. The betting handle was a record, up $18.16 million, and the TV audience was the biggest it's been for 35 years. And it does go to show that if all the stars align, you can still have an event that cuts through. I don't know how, but you can.
Yeah, I think Britain should be looking at that very closely. First of all, enviously, and then.
But the thing is, I mean, sorry, Lydia, to interrupt. I think I've got to qualify that. It's clearly a massive outlier. I mean, it's a massive, massive outlier, but it's still a glorious outlier.
Yeah, I understand, but generally, if we have outliers in Britain, they would tend to be in the opposite direction at the moment. Sadly, that is just the landscape. I suppose I mean in a more detailed kind of way. I'm not talking about ever hoping to emulate numbers like that. Obviously, I'm talking more about the things that can be learned and translated to a British context. So, I was asking you about why you thought that NBC Sports was able to achieve such a massive viewing figure, the biggest in 35 years. And you were saying you thought it was down to cross promotion. Now, that was what was singularly lacking from an ITV perspective, certainly to my eyes and my understanding, particularly for this year's Grand National. Now, whether that was the heebie-jeebies internally from shadowy figures high up in ITV wondering about last year's Grand National and thinking, you know, that was such an awful watch. How closely do we actually want to be associated to it? How much do we back it? I'm not talking about ITV Racing. I'm talking about more the hierarchy of the channel. And was it down to viewers who had such an awful viewing experience last year thinking, well, I'm not going to watch this time around? But that cross-promotion element seems to me to be key. You've got a good perspective on both. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I can only speak from the programme that I worked on, and it struck me straight away as soon as I got to Kentucky that this was still a national event. This still had national resonance. Every time you turned on the major channels, the local affiliates would be at Churchill Downs. Now, we don't have regional television in the same way as we did in the 70s and 80s, sadly, in the UK. Everything's become so much more centralized, but it did go to show you know, that the power of the local pull, particularly, and then across the other NBC properties, there were mentions of Kentucky Derby everywhere on every news and entertainment show. You know, Jimmy Fallon and all the rest of it, Kelly Clarkson. So it's not that hard, you know, to get some of your biggest stars to at least alert people to the fact that the race exists. I don't think it's that much more complicated.
And do you think that's something that can be learned over here?
I don't see why not. I mean, I just don't think it's all that hard. Now, in fairness, ITV got a 60 share for this year's Grand National, which is very, very strong. I mean, it did suggest that the actual TV or viewing audience on the day was very low because it still got a 60 share. But I still was left with a feeling that simply not enough people knew that it was going ahead.
Certainly, my consciousness of that was, I mean, it was to me apparent at the time that the only awareness in the wider media that the National was happening was in order to have some negative stories about it. There wasn't anything that I encountered. And, you know, I do tend to, from a sort of journalistic perspective, keep an eye on the media in the run-up to big events like that to see what, if any, cut-through the sport is having. And the cut-through was negative.
Are there any other notable performances from the weekend that you want to particularly pick out? I know there was a Charlie Appleby 2-year-old that you wanted to alert me to that I haven't watched yet.
Yes, Mountain Breeze, closely related to Pinatubo, who has been mentioned in passing already. She was very, very good, winning over 5 furlongs on her racecourse debut. She was particularly strong inside the final furlong, put a great deal of distance between her and other precociously bred fillies. I think that Charlie Appleby and William Buick are thinking Albany, and maybe via another race, the National Stakes, a stiff 5 furlongs at Sandown would be an obvious one, but she looked pretty smart. Friendly Soul won the Pretty Polly. being harried by Kalpana all the way to the line, wide margin success, a significant success for Kieran Schumacher since he has teamed up with the Gosdens this season as the de facto stable jockey. And you were pointing out, and I have since read these, the very, very telling words from John Gosden, bearing in mind the conversation that you and I had about this last week.
Yeah, if you weren't listening last week, Lydia and I teamed up on, what was it, Thursday?
Yes.
Yeah, and we were saying, when is a number one jockey not a number one jockey?
Well, no, it was Tuesday. It was Tuesday, Nick. That tells what tells you what kind of week you and I've had.
No idea what time zone I'm on, let alone what time or day it is. Yeah, and we were saying, well, when's a stable jockey not a stable jockey, et cetera, et cetera. And John Gosden gave a ringing endorsement of his, as he described him, number one. And there was definitely a line in there. I don't know if you've got it or picked it out.
Which
suggested to me that he was urging his owners to get in behind him.
Well, I'll read the whole thing, but I think it's the last two sentences that you're referring to. So Kieran is very mature, John Gosden said. This is to Lee Mottershead in the Racing Post. He has been through it all in every sense. He is a talented young man with very good hands and good judgment. He is a horseman who really understands horses. I just hope I have horses in our stable who are good enough for him to show his talents, because if your car isn't quick enough, you shouldn't go blaming the driver. I've seen that happen before. Frankie and I went through it during a few dud years. This is the key bit, I think. If you believe in someone, you have to be strong when people come along with bright ideas saying they want to try so and so. You need a bit of consistency. That, in effect, is a on the record plea to his owners or stating a position by John Gosden to his owners that he is backing Kieran Schumacher and he wants them to back him too. And that if they don't, then they're going to meet some resistance.
Okay, so after last week's gastronomic disappointments that you highlighted on social media,
it wasn't just gastronomic. There was a lack of a big screen by the paddock, and there was no bus, the long-standing bus shuttle service for people who aren't able to walk easily from the Esher station to Sandown was as far as I can tell without notice cancelled. You know, there were people left stranded at the station. There were a lot of failings at Sandown that day.
Okay, how was Newmarket the weekend?
Harder to tell because I had less downtime and you're not so immersed in the experience. It looked like there was a big crowd on Saturday. Their traffic management could have been better, but nonetheless, that was partly down to the fact that there was a big crowd, and that, a lot of that has got to be driven by City of Troy. You know, the non-hype, the fair billing of City of Troy. I think that a lot of people wanted to come to see a very good horse. There was an odd sort of feel in terms of the Friday having six races and pretty thin fields at that, to then go to the Saturday and have nine races, which for those people around the world who say just nine, we have 14 or whatever. Nine is a lot in Britain. And although that we're increasingly getting it on the all weather, generally it's seven and you might get eight, but nine is a lot. And the weird thing about that was
it depends how long the tail is, doesn't it? That's the point.
Well, that's exactly the point I'm making. Race five was in Britain, 2,000 guineas.
Yeah, and in the US, okay, we have 14 races on Saturday, but you know, it wasn't like it was dribbling away at the end. The Kentucky Derby was at 7 o'clock. You know, it starts slow and builds. Whereas if you've got the guineas and then another five races after that or whatever, it's Phil de Freitas batting at eight, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really. I mean, it felt like
teenagers there.
It felt like a bit of an endurance test by the end. Clearly, it's Whirlpool or betting driven income. And there was a knock-on beneficial effect, I suspect, in terms of traffic management on the way out, in that lots of people didn't see out the full trip and went out, probably because they came to see City of Troy, they weren't so interested in a number of big field handicaps, or maybe they just found eight, nine races of massive fields just too much. So the exiting traffic from Newmarket was better. I was pleasantly surprised that there appeared to be, and obviously I don't know for certain because I wasn't in all parts of the racecourse at once, there appeared to be no fracas. And I did notice that Newmarket did have police on hand, which, you know, one of the flaws in the past have been where there has been fights breaking out, where it is that there haven't been, the racecourses haven't had police there and have gone for private security firms instead, if that. So that was, it was good to see that, because your concern about a 9-race card is that you'll get a lot of alcohol being consumed over that period of time. Maybe racecourses have finally mercifully moved away from that, get as much drink into them as possible model. But it did feel on the Saturday like there was a sort of deprioritization of the race day customer at the racecourse, because that the way that card was set up was not to their benefit, was it? Unless you're a real glutton for punishment and you love 9 races and massive fields, in which case maybe it was, and you're getting a lot of bang for your buck, I suppose.
As I say, I don't think it. I don't object to 9 races in and of itself. I think it's just the way that they're set out and structured and timed and et cetera.
But that's what I mean. So
yeah, you've just got to put a bit more. You can put a bit more thought if you need the 9 races.
But there must be something driving the Guineas to be race 5 of 9.
Well, I'm presuming you're trying to fit it into a TV window and you're trying to please Whirlpool at the same time.
That's what I'm assuming it is too. But okay. That's why I mean it's a deprioritization of what a race day customer would want. If a race day customer was going along, if let's say they do love 9 race cards, and they'll want to be building towards it being race 8, wouldn't they? The big race of the day, not race five.
I'd say so. But that's then it requires a kind of cultural shift, doesn't it? Requires people's mindset to switch into that. Do I mind having the best race as the penultimate race on the card or whatever? And must just, before we finish, Lydia, talk about the Jockeys Championship in Ireland, because I feel really bad if I didn't give Jack Kennedy a proper mention. Everyone's forgotten about it already and what's happened over the weekend, but I'm really thrilled for him.
It's great to see him win his first championship. This is somebody who's been plagued by injury whilst at the same time showing everybody what a huge talent he is as a rider. He's broken his leg, for example, 5 times in 8 years. And that's just one of the footnotes about the things that he's broken. I think he's actually got a broken foot at the moment. He had a fall in a handicap hurdle at Bellerstown on the 24th of April. And when I saw him on the Tuesday of the Punchestown Festival, he was limping quite badly. He'd just been unseated from Dancing Jeremy as well, for good measure. But he was managing to ride on, as we know, jockeys, particularly jump jockeys, so often do through that pain. He'd amassed, the final total was 123 to him, 121 to Paul Townend. So that brought to the end Paul Townend's run. He'd won the previous 6 championships. Jack Kennedy, he's been with Gordon Elliott since he was 13 or 14 years of age, and he built up a formidable reputation in pony racing, which he almost immediately seamlessly transferred to the big league. And Gordon Elliott was clearly very moved by Jack Kennedy's success and called it one of his happiest days. There are a couple, I think, that Paul Townend will feel or should feel got away from him, and there are a couple of significant ones as well.
Yes, the obvious ones, Galopande Shaw and Gaelic Warrior. I'm not sure about Galopin des Champs. Isn't he just vastly superior to his rivals when the ground is soft and it's a real test, and he's better than his rivals when it's good ground?
I think it was good soft ground. It was good soft when he won the Gold Cup last season, which remains his second best ever career performance, and I would argue is actually possibly his best. I know on figures the Savills Chase domination is that, but I think there was more opposition for longer in the 2023 Cheltenham Gold Cup. I don't think he's as ground dependent as everybody says. I do think he is tactics dependent. Now, he was bounced out in the Punchestown Gold Cup, prominence on the inside. He actually jumped the first in the lead, and then he was narrowly headed by Conflated, who doesn't really have the stamina for that trip and was going to predictably jump left, which is exactly what he did. But Paul Townend notably restrained Galopin des Champs a couple of times, to the point where the horse put down at the third and Fast or Slow jumped past him. That was the race winning move from JJ Sleven, and he solidified it at fence 4. End of race there. Afterwards, Willie Mullins said he didn't think that Galopin des Champs should jumped well enough to make the running when I asked whether the race had turned into a bit too much of a speed test at the trip and it needed to be more of a stamina test for a strong stayer like Galopin de Chaume. And he said that he didn't jump well enough to make the running. But all season long, since the John Durkin and what we saw in the Savills Chase, they've been arguing that the horse jumps better when prominent, when ridden positively. And that's explicitly what they didn't do there. I mean, it almost seemed to me, when you add it to Gaelic Warrior, that Paul Townend was riding soft ground factions on good to soft ground. And again, Gaelic Warrior, who benefited from a really strong pace set by Matata in the Arkle, found a 50 taking over approaching 2 hours, and then Gaelic Warrior sauntering into that race between the final two fences and powering away. Here he fell victim to a steadily run race where Ilete Tom was able to show a better turn of foot. And again, you know, Gaelic Warrior can make his own running, just like Galopin de Chaume can. So I feel those were two that got away with two conservative fractions being set on those horses.
OK, have you got a tip for me for today?
I do. So I'm going to go to Windsor for that. And it was just a two-year-old that caught my eye at the Craven meeting called Usario Amigo, who ran really well there. He was pretty green behind Kikuli. He was also not particularly well positioned during a meeting that, without exception, favoured horses that were on the pace. He was just a bit too green to do that slowly away, but he did look like he was learning all the time. So it is Usario Amigo, and that's in the 2:35 at Windsor today.
Fabulous. Lydia, thanks so much. Thank you very much for listening. It's great to be back. That was Monday, May the 6th. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the Racing App in partnership with FitStairs.